Well, thank you so much for coming on such a beautiful day. Winter is arriving. I hear snow is in the forecast at some point, and of course the interior, it's already arrived. And we are at the end of practice period. We successfully concluded our weeks of a little more intensive practice and our study of the Vimalakirti Sutra. And I was thinking, you know, we gave so many talks on Vimalakirti, so many talks, both at Loon Lake when we did our week-long retreat and also here. And you probably had your full of Vimalakirti. And if so, I have to apologize, because guess what I'm going to talk about? I'd like to bring forward actually a koan, one of the kind of short Zen stories and sayings, etc., that are compiled in these collections. and this koan does focus on Vimalakirti. It's found both in the Book of Serenity, for those people who know the koan collections, and also in the Blue Cliff Record. And it's really unusual to actually have a piece taken from a text, a kind of sutra or a Buddhist text like the Vimalakirti, and then plunked into the koan collections. Anyway, both the koans from the Blue Cliff and from the Book of Serenity are pretty similar. So I'm just going to read you quickly the translation of from the Book of Serenity, and it's case 48. And maybe I'll just preface all this by saying Vimalakirti is a layperson who was a very amazing practitioner of the Buddhist tradition. And this whole text, the whole sutra that we've been studying about, Vimalakirti gives many teachings, both to monks, but also to bodhisattvas, people who are very far advanced, you could think of perhaps in their practice. Anyway, here we go. Vimalakirti asked Manjushri, the very bodhisattva of wisdom, "What does it mean that the bodhisattva enters the Dharma gate of not two?" Right, Dharma gate of unity, right? It's kind of another way of putting it, of not two. Manjushri said, "I see it like this. In all phenomena, there are neither words nor explanations, neither presentations nor knowledge. It is beyond all questions and answers. That is what I understand with to enter the Dharma gate of not two." And then Manjushri asked Vimalakirti, "All of us have finished giving our explanations." There were other bodhisattvas who were explaining as well. He said, "All of us have finished our explanations. Now you should give your explanation. What does it mean that a bodhisattva enters the Dharma gate of not two?" And Vimalakirti remained silent. Now, if you have followed the talks we've been given, have been giving over the practice period, you notice that this koan really closely follows the Vimalakirti Sutra itself. And as I said, that's very unusual for the koan tradition. So in the sutra, remember, all the bodhisattvas have gathered and other monks have gathered in Vimalakirti's sick room. All were discussing the best ways to enter the Dharma gate of non-duality. And a number of them had spoken. Manjushri gives his explanation. And Manjushri, this bodhisattva of wisdom, is highly respected for his elegance. Sometimes you'll see him carrying a scroll in statues, you know, because carrying the Dharma. He's supposed to be very famous, well known for being able to explain the Dharma in beautiful language so everyone can understand. And yet, when Vimalakirti is asked, he just is silent. And in the sutra, Manjushri praises Vimalakirti for his silence. Ah, the the height of explanation. Say nothing. Now, I was going to talk about this particular koan for my last talk during session, during the retreat that we were just at, but decided instead to talk about some passages in the sutra on compassion. Anyway, what struck me about this particular koan, separate from the idea of its, from the sutra, was its holding up of non-duality. And I noticed in myself, and I'm sure with perhaps everyone, when we hold up this idea of unity or of non-duality, its partner, duality, immediately comes forward. Unbidden. Right? It's just there. So much of our life and our thinking is based on duality, right? Life, death, love, hate, good, bad, left, right, up, down, me, you, us, them, etc., etc. In our daily life, we seem to oscillate between gain and loss, me and you, praise and blame, success and failure, joy and sorrow, having and losing, being with, being alone. Right? Doesn't it seem that way? We're back and forth, back and forth. So much of our discomfort and suffering arises from swinging, I think, between dualities. I suspect that the years of COVID restrictions and fear have kind of left us collectively with more sensitivity and suspicious of dualities that we encounter in our lives. Like not quite trusting. Oh, that person over there is so different. And certainly the media today paints a bleak picture of the extreme polarization, right? That in both the political world and in the social realms, with almost no middle ground possible. So I wonder, have we become beings memorized by the binary? Dealing with the dualities really is a great part of the struggle of practice, both on and off the zazen seat. So easily, and I notice this certainly in myself, so easily do we take up positions proclaiming, even if it's just to ourselves, a strong or scattered period of zazen I just had, right? Oh, that was such a good period of zazen. Oh, that period before that was just terrible. And, you know, everything else, like the good, the bad experience that we just had, the right and wrong action that we did or didn't do or someone else did or didn't do, the best and the worst, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you can fill in the blank immediately, one or the other. So on a practical level, I wonder if we have lost, or at least weakened, our ability to listen with the intent to understand, rather than with the intent to refute and somehow cook up positions for my position, cook up reasons for my position. There is a Zen expression that reminds us that beyond duality and non-duality, relative and absolute, being and non-being, and all those other binary positions we come up with, there is the mysterious dynamic of it all. And this Zen expression is not one, not two. So simple. Not one, not two. And Dogen, the Japanese monk who brought this form of practice from China into Japan way back in the 1200s and kind of founded our particular lineage, calls the experience of this dynamic of not one, not two, actualizing the fundamental point. Actualizing the fundamental point. Not one, not two. And for Dogen, as we know, for all us who have read Dogen, studied Dogen's writings, The gateway to actualizing the fundamental point is our zazen, our practice. In the Vimalakirti Sutra, there is one very instructive encounter illustrating our tendency for preferences, which of course is another kind of duality, right? Last night, Kate and I, after a delicious dinner, splurged and went for ice cream. And immediately preferences arise, right? And we were allowed two tastes at this nice ice cream shop, right? So, oh God, how do you decide? Two tastes. Okay, this one and this one. And then you have to choose which one you're actually going to get, right? Preferences upon preferences. So this dialogue in the sutra happens between a disciple of the Buddha, Mahakashapa, and Vimalakirti. So Mahakashapa is one of the disciples, and he's begging amongst a village. And Mahakashapa favored the villages of the poor when begging for his daily food, which was, of course, the custom at the time. And one day, Vimalakirti appears before him and said to him, "Reverend Mahakashapa, to avoid the houses of the wealthy and to favor the houses of the poor, this is discriminating between the rich and poor. When you beg, it should be with an attitude of equanimity and compassion for all sentient beings." When I first read this, several weeks ago when we were in the sutra itself, it kind of shocked me a little bit because I realized my own tendency. When I read the news, well, I'll just say it. You know, when I think of Trump and some of the things that Trump does, it's really hard to have compassion for this person, or at least how they appear in the media. Of course, never met them. But just, I have to watch this in myself. How easy it could be, you know, them, that person, the other. And certainly our Zen ancestors have always encouraged their students through their writings, and through their writings encourage us to courageously step beyond our habitual dualistic thinking. In the Xinxin Ming, or in English, Trust in Mind, one of the great teaching poems that coming from the Chinese Zen or Chan tradition, supposedly written by the third patriarch of the Chinese tradition, Sangsan. Anyway, in this poem, we are strongly encouraged over and over again to open up beyond our preferences. And there's many translations of this poem. It's kind of long, so I'll just read the opening verses. "The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When not attached to love or hate, all is clear and undisguised. Separate by the smallest amount, however, and you are as far from it as heaven is from earth. If you wish to know the truth, then hold to no opinions for or against. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind." So many translations of this seminal poem that we can find now in English. And I'd like to add that we can easily understand when we read the whole poem that Sansang is not saying judgments and ideas are dangerous and need to be abandoned, but rather that we must see beyond them to that clear place of not one, not two. But if we hold on to our opinions and preferences, you know, that kind of this is the truth type of tight grip, then we can't know the truth. Remember, as Manjushri said in the koan that I just read, I see it like this. In all phenomena, there are neither words nor explanations, neither presentations nor knowledge. It's beyond all questions and answers. In other words, really seeing, experiencing this not one, not two, seeing the truth of things is really beyond words. Perhaps. Now, the heart of this koan, of course, is Vimalakirti's silence, his response of silence. And I think silence is an interesting word because, like the word space, silence describes the presence of absence. Silence describes the presence of absence. Now, silence can be both a Dharma gate to deepen our understanding of who we are. And silence can also be a door slamming shut in our face. For example, when I was a child, it wasn't unusual to be told to be quiet when adults were talking. A kind of lingering influence left over from that, you know, children should be seen and not heard. And, of course, after some bad experiences of being put down, we may be afraid to speak, retreating into a kind of a painful and cold silence rather than sharing and open. Many have been and are, of course, silenced in our world today. Women, indigenous populations, the underclass, minorities, racialized groups, those who protest against authoritarian leaders and powers, and I'm sure you can add and add to that list. For sadly, it is a long one. And the ways of being silenced are many. So in our practice, in our life, we do need to be aware of when we inappropriately silence ourselves or when we inadvertently silence others. But Vimalakirti silence is not cold or a frightened silence. It is something else. In every contemplative tradition that I know of, there is a high regard for silence as an integral part of the spiritual life. The Trappist monk and writer Thomas Merton wrote this about silence. He wrote, "Silence has many dimensions. It can be a regression, an escape, a loss of self, or it can be a presence, awareness, unification, self-discovery. Negative silence blurs and confuses our identity, and we lapse into daydreams or diffuse anxieties. Positive silence pulls us together and makes us realize who we are, who we may be, and the distance between the two. Hence, positive silence implies a choice and what Paul Tillich called courage to be." Paul Tillich was a great Catholic theologian and a renegade, which made him a great theologian, in my opinion. In our Zen retreats, our Zen sessions and other kinds of daily retreats, etc., we practice noble silence. And noble silence is a term used originally to describe when the Buddha simply refused to answer what he considered to be unanswerable or unhelpful questions. Instead of using words that would be unhelpful, the Buddha chose silence instead. In one famous encounter, the Buddha was asked what are referred to in the early Buddhist text as the 14 unanswerable questions. For example, is the world eternal or not or both? Or neither? Is the world infinite or not or both or neither? Is the self identical with the body or different from the body or both, et cetera, et cetera. It goes on and on. Anyway, there's 14 unanswerable questions that some smart guy was trying to ask the Buddha and the Buddha's quiet. And then at some point, the noble silence also came to represent the commitment not to speak during retreats, not as a form of renunciation, but as a way to help calm the mind. So at our Mountain Rain Zen retreats, we avoid unnecessary speech and we avoid social talking. And for some of our for some participants, that means, other than perhaps chanting at service, not speaking at all throughout the day. It's a gift to oneself and to others for this kind of silence, because it brings forth presence. It births clear awareness. Or maybe we could say that noble silence is the silence that opens inside when the mind is calm and at ease. At the Loon Lake Session, the Loon Lake retreat that we just finished, Kate talked about opening to sound in one of her talks as a practice of Zazen. The practice of listening without commentary, practice of listening with an inner stillness. And when this inner silence is present and the environment is quiet, we can become aware of the sounds of our body, the heart beating, our breath, the blood flowing through. And we may also become aware of a continuous and slight buzzing or ringing, a kind of background vibration or white noise. In Sanskrit, that sound is known as nada, which nada, the Sanskrit, simply means sound, but it's a particular sound that arises when we're in a still, quiet environment and the mind is still. And some traditions use this sound that we become aware of as an object of concentration, rather than the breath, for example. Also known as the sound of silence, nada has no beginning and no end. It's just continuous and present, just always there, at least as long as we're alive. It's always there. For us humans, there is no experience of absolute silence, even in an anechoic chamber. An anechoic chamber is kind of like those really intense soundproof chambers used for scientific experiments and stuff. There, we will always hear sound, even when we're sitting in there. The subtle sounds we experience in our body, and they too can become a Dharma gate to the not one, not two. Another Zen teacher, Katagiri Dainin Roshi, one of the first Japanese Soto Zen teachers to bring again this tradition from Japan to North America, he wrote this, and he said, Zazen is to come back to no sound. Come back to the sound of no sound and see it. It's not just your limited territory. It is a vastness from which your capacity, your knowledge, and your nature comes. Just like spring water coming up from the earth. This is Zazen, exactly. This is you. Now, I try to go for a run twice a week. Because where we live, there are a number of wonderful trails in nature to run on. Kate and I call them walk runs. Mm-hmm. Because I run, Kate walks. And yet, while I'm there, often, you know, a runner passes me by. And I notice frequently they have earbuds in, listening, I suppose, to music or perhaps a podcast. And I feel saddened every time I see it, because I know they're missing the silence of nature, which is not really silent, I grant you. But where better to listen to silence than in nature, than in the wild? Several years ago, I read a book called One Square Inch of Silence, One Man's Quest to Preserve Quiet, by an acoustic ecologist, Gordon Hepton. And I think Kate has mentioned this book in a Dharma talk quite a while ago. So Gordon Hepton has made it his mission to record and preserve all the natural terrestrial soundscapes in their amazing variety before they disappear in this rising tide of human-made noise. And Hempton's book describes his journey to find what he calls the one square inch of silence that is the quietest place in the United States. And he finds that spot in the Kohrain Forest of the Olympic National Park, a place free of airplane noise and all human-caused sound. And I meant to look up how many flights happen in the United States every day. And I forgot to do that. But he was hard-pressed to find a place that was free of airplane sound. The book also details his concern for the naturally quiet, that may soon be non-existent in our world, perhaps even in just the next 10 years. He points out refrigerators, air conditioning systems, traffic, airplanes, leaf blowers, and where Kate and I live, chainsaws, are few of the things that have become part of the ambient sound that prevents us from really listening to the natural sounds of our environment. And I would add to that, plugging in earbuds while on a hike or a run in nature is another kind of human-made noise that prevents us from connecting to the land and to ourselves. He writes at the end of his book, "Saving silence is not an inconvenient chore, but an awakening joy. When we listen to silence, we hear not absence, but presence. I cannot imagine a future without quiet, nor do I care to try." Let's go back to the koan for a second. The koan tells us that when Vimalakirti was asked by Manjushri, "Okay, now you give your explanation, buddy. What does it mean to enter the Dharma gate of non-duality?" And of course, Vimalakirti just kept quiet. His silence has been called the voiceless voice, compared to the famous koan by the Japanese Zen teacher Hakuin, "What is the sound of one hand? What is the sound of one hand?" Vimalakirti's silence is beyond the opposites of words and silence. One commentator wrote, "Vimalakirti is the silence. Vimalakirti's silence is beyond the opposites of words and silence. It is the silence." But as we know, silence is not always the answer. In the Vimalakirti Sutra, there is an amusing scene where a goddess who is present at the gathering in Vimalakirti's sick room challenges Shariputra, one of Buddha's foremost disciples, to speak. That, in fact, his silence is simply an evasion. Here's the little dialogue. Shariputra says to the goddess, "Oh, so you've been here a long time? What a lame way to talk to a goddess, right?" In the room. "Oh, so you've been here a long time?" "Venerable sir," said the goddess, "how long has your attainment of awakening been?" And Shariputra was silent, did not answer. The goddess said, "With your great wisdom, venerable sir, why do you remain silent?" And Shariputra replied, "Awakening cannot be spoken of in words. Therefore, I do not know what I can say to you." And here's the goddess again. The goddess said, "Words, writing, are all marks of awakening. Because awakening is not internal, nor external, not in between. And words, likewise, are not internal, nor external, and not in between. Therefore, Shariputra, you can speak of awakening without putting words aside. Because all things exist, they are all marks of awakening." Isn't that lovely? You know, whoever wrote this sutra, you know, just said, "You think you got it? Right? You think silence is the answer? Well, here. Chew on this." So truly, our experience of silence is manifold, right? Sometimes inclusive, sometimes excluding. A gate to non-duality, or sometimes isolating, cutting us off. Reflecting on this koan, let's take up the practice of opening to the silence in our daily lives, making space when we can stop for a little while and just listen to the outer and the inner sounds, receiving the silence that is the foundation of all sounds. Aware in those moments, please just rest in the brilliance of the now and the here. So I'd like to end with a haiku by Basho. And I want to end with this because for me this has a particular meaning, but it's not quite meaning, poignancy. As a young man, I studied Aikido in Japan for a number of years with a lovely man, Hayakawa-sensei. But he had a lot of biases as well. And because I was not Japanese, he said, "You cannot really appreciate this poem." So let me read it first in Japanese, and then I'll read it in English. Shizukasaya iwa ni shimiiru semi no koi. Deep silence, the shrill of cicadas, seeps into rocks. Deep silence, the shrill of cicadas, seeps into rocks. I had never heard a cicada until I went to Japan. I know they're back east, right? But in Japan, I don't know about back east, but they can be incredibly loud. And it is a really shrill of a sound, some of them. Wee, 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 wee And of course, there's many more than one, all going at the same time. Yes, it seeps into rocks. Thank you so much for listening.